When it comes to Kingston real estate, local experience matters. Kim Purcell is an award-winning realtor born and raised in Kingston with over a decade of experience and 100 five-star reviews. If you want honest advice and results you can trust, choose Kim. Visit kimpurcell.ca today for more information.
Hello and welcome to The Corridor here on CFRC 101.9 FM in Kingston, Ontario, and podcasting on Spotify and Apple Music. I'm Dinah Jansen, and with me is CFRC Local Journalism Initiative news producer Jesse Bell. This regional news program features news from Kingston and area provided by local and regional journalists through the support of the Local Journalism Initiative and the Community Radio Fund of Canada. Welcome and enjoy. Hello and welcome to The Corridor, brought to you by Realtor Kim Purcell of Sutton Group Masters Realty. Connect with Kim today to find a new home tomorrow via kimpurcell.ca. I'm Dinah Jansen, and with me is CFRC's Local Journalism Initiative producer, Jesse Bell. Our top story is from CFRC's Local Journalism Initiative reporter, Christina Laurie, covering the return of the Kingston Climate Summit.
Hello, I'm Christina Laurie, Local Journalism Initiative reporter for CFRC 101.9 FM in Kingston, Ontario. Coming up are some of the top news stories in Kingston and the Islands. You can listen to CFRC's news programs today in YGK and Kingston Currents on Mondays, Wednesdays, and Thursdays at 5 p.m. or subscribe to our podcasts on Spotify and Apple Music. If you have any Kingston news tips you'd like to share, you can reach me at news@cfrc.ca. The Kingston Climate Summit is returning this summer, bigger and more ambitious than its inaugural year. Presented by Sustainable Kingston, ICLEI Canada, and the city, last year's event brought together community members for a full day of panels, workshops, and conversations focused on local climate solutions. Now, organizers are building on that momentum. The 2026 summit expands to a two-day event. This year's summit, themed Shaping Our Future Together, will take place June 3rd and 4th at St. Lawrence College. Julia Stroud, Executive Director of Sustainable Kingston, sat down with CFRC to share what's in store. Well, to start us off, the summit is expanding to 2 days in only its second year. I was wondering if you could speak to what came out of that first event that made you go, we've got something here that we need to build on.
Yeah, so we had a fabulous time last year, and I will add that actually it was just a week before I started in this role, but I was able to attend as a community member. And it was just this fascinating mix of people coming together who are working in the field as well as interested community members. And it was a mix of speakers and workshops and tours. And so we've been able to add an extra half day. So that will expand the speaker section. But we're also going to have the tours again. Last year, the tours were focused on getting active with transportation, food farming and forests, and climate action across Kingston. So we're still working on the themes for this year, but they were a lot of fun last year. And so I know a few people have already said that they're really excited that it'll be offered again.
Awesome. And you mentioned there's going to be some more room for speakers this year. I was wondering if you could expand upon what this expansion makes room for in terms of both the programming and the overall experience.
So with expanding the speakers, we'll just have a little bit more room to delve into a few subject areas. So the overall theme for the summit this year is biodiversity. So that you might have started noticing that everywhere. That seems to be the theme across Canada and a lot of other countries as well. And so we'll delve into that in a couple of areas, both within the speakers and also within the workshops themselves.
Awesome. And how are we kind of building on this momentum from last year?
Well, I mean, that event last year came together quite quickly, and it had great attendance. And so I think we'll expand a little bit more into other parts of Kingston, but also the region as well.
And the theme is Shaping Our Future Together. I was wondering if you could speak a bit to what that means for Kingston right now and why it's so important for community members to get involved in this conversation.
Yeah, I think it's particularly important because, as I mentioned, the theme that's emerging is biodiversity. And biodiversity is not only really important because that's what we're finding is, you know, it can reduce species loss. It can also be a sink for emissions. But it's also, it's visible. It's fun. Right? It's something you can do on your own property or your business. It's something you can see. And so I think that's quite exciting because a lot of climate action can be quite frankly, a little bit sad. You know, it's always the things are getting worse, things are getting worse. Well, biodiversity is actually really hopeful. All the other work is also super important, but biodiversity is something that people can actively do and every little bit counts. And so it's quite an exciting area to be expanding into.
Again, you mentioned there, we're talking about biodiversity this year. What are some of the biggest climate priorities and challenges facing Kingston that we may see addressed in the programming this year?
Yeah, so Kingston has actually started on its biodiversity action plan. And so that is a process that will take a number of months, but obviously highly relevant here. It also just finalized its adaptation and resilience plan. So that came out a month ago. And so that's available online for anybody to take a look. And so it'll be continuing those same themes, you know, how can we become more resilient as a community, which, again, everybody plays a part in that, both larger organizations, the government, as well as individuals.
Mm-hmm. And I was wondering if you could speak to a bit what the audience for this looked like last year and who you're hoping comes out this year.
So last year it was a good mix of community members and people working in the field. So, you know, people in small nonprofits or Queen's University, the city itself. This year we're hoping to see all those same people, plus a few more, really. I think it would be great to see people from lots of different fields just because this is relevant for all of us. So it's partly just people working in the field, but also for other community members and other organizations to kind of see themselves in climate work because we all can do something about it.
Mm-hmm. And I was wondering if you had any goals this year. What will success look like for this year's summit?
I think success will look like expanded partnership. So that's the other aspect that we're delving into. So there's the Kingston Climate Partnership, which is new. It was announced at the last summit, and we'll be talking a little bit about what we've accomplished over the year, what we're working on. And if that grows and connections are made, you know, someone from one organization meets someone from a different organization, they realize they have something they can work on, I mean, that would be amazing.
Awesome. And no spoilers, but I was wondering if you could give us maybe some of the stuff that you've been working on since last year's summit.
So the partnership has come together. We've signed on quite a number of organizations and we've formed working groups. So there are four working groups within the partnership. There's buildings and energy, biodiversity, food, and integrated mobility. And we've started meeting as groups with the idea that really we will find projects to work on. So this is partly knowledge sharing, but also just an opportunity to seriously advance climate action in the community.
Awesome. And how can folks learn more about this year's summit and get involved?
Yeah, so there's a couple of ways. If you go on our website, which is sustainablekingston.com, there's the event page there, and also through the City of Kingston's page.
That was Julia Stroud, Executive Director of Sustainable Kingston, on this year's Kingston Climate Summit. Organizers say the full lineup, including keynote speakers, will be announced in the coming weeks. For CFRC News, supported by the Local Journalism Initiative, this has been Christina Laurie.
Thank you, Chris. Now over to Jesse Bell with a story by Michelle Dory Forstell, LJR reporter for The Kingstonist, about a Kingston firefighter making waves at the Boston Marathon.
Thank you, Dinah. When Joseph Reed crossed the finish line at the Boston Marathon, the time on the clock wasn't what mattered to him. On Monday, April 20th, 21 years after his first run on the notoriously difficult course, the Kingston area firefighter returned with a different goal, to enjoy the experience, even if that meant running sideways, handing out thousands of high fives, and doing it all dressed as Gord Downie. Reed said his 2005 Boston Marathon debut, just his second ever marathon, quote, didn't go well. Reed stated that he wanted to make amends for that performance and, quote, go back and enjoy it this time. That attitude shaped his return from the outset. Reed qualified at the 2024 Toronto Waterfront Marathon for this year's Boston race, but arrived in Boston without a time goal. Instead, he leaned into the experience, one widely regarded as among the most prestigious and demanding marathons in the world. Known for its rolling hills and relentless elevation changes, the course winds through communities outside Boston before finishing downtown. Reed said runners are rarely given a break due to the rolling nature of the course, but what Boston lacks in flat terrain, it makes up for in atmosphere. With crowds lining nearly every stretch of the 42.2-kilometer route, Reed said the spectators ultimately dictated how he ran. That connection became the point. Rather than running the most efficient line, Reed zigzagged across the course, stopping to interact with spectators and sharing what he estimated were tens of thousands of high fives. He carried a Canadian flag in one hand and abandoned any conventional pacing strategy. He finished in 3 hours, 48 minutes, and 56 seconds, nearly an hour off his personal best, a difference that reflected his approach more than his ability. His outfit, inspired by Gord Downie's iconic look from the Tragically Hip's final concert in Kingston, ensured that he stood out. In Boston, though, that reference didn't always land. Quote, "Really early on, I realized I was Jaws and not Gord Downie," Reed said. Still, he added that there were worse things to be called. While many spectators didn't recognize the tribute, Reed said that the disconnect became part of the experience rather than a distraction. The costume dates back to 2017 when Reed first wore it at the Toronto Waterfront Marathon, just days after Downey's death, while raising money for the Gord Downie and Charlie Wenjack Fund. Reed noted that his outfit was more personal given the political tensions between the United States and Canada. Reed stated that his Downey-inspired look, quote, "wasn't meant to be political, but rather a way to pay tribute to a well-known Kingstonian and introduce Americans to a Canadian icon." Channeling Downey's connection with the crowd, the eye contact, the intensity, the sense of presence, became central to how Reed approached the race. Reed, who grew up in Napanee and now lives in Kingston while working as a firefighter in Toronto, said running has long been part of how he stays fit for the job. But marathons, he admits, tend to start with something less structured. Looking back, Reed said it's not a single moment that stands out from this year's Boston Marathon, but the overall experience, the crowds, the connection, and the chance to return to the race on his own terms. And while he admits his first thought after crossing the finish line was that he might never do it again, he also knows better by now. Thank you to Michelle Dory Forrestel of The Kingstonist for that story. Coming up, we have a story by Brenda Little from CJPE County Radio about a new contemporary art show in Prince Edward County.
The Annex building of the Royal Hotel in Prince Edward County was busy over the weekend, with the public excited to experience the Hotel Confidential Contemporary Art Show. Four rooms and accessible areas were transformed by 16 local and international artists with sculpture, music, textiles, and so much more, inspired by classic hotel-themed movies. Curators Stacey Spruill and Christina Zeidler tell us more about the exhibition.
Hotel in Toronto called the Gladstone Hotel, which still exists, mm-hmm. but my tenure is done there. But it had 365 days a year of art, but one of our signature shows was called Come Up to My Room. Hmm. And it was artists and designers collaborating in rooms on our second floor and really transforming the space. We did it for 17 years. And it's probably one of the most, I didn't realize this until doing this project, it's one of the most remembered things. And people yes. keep saying, oh, this is like this thing that used to happen in this hotel in Toronto. It's like, But one of the nice things is that that's just my history yes. and coming here. And this project is really a new collaboration. Yeah. And we had a different context here at the Royal of, we couldn't change these hotel rooms mm-hmm. there, and they're really of the Royal. So we looked for artists who had craft in their background, mm-hmm. and that doesn't mean just material craft, it's also their process, that they have a process to their work. And we carefully chose artists, hand-picked, and brought them into collaboration. And then conceptually, we gave them sort of as a backstory the idea that how hotels are represented on film. So we picked six films that could be jumping off points. So as a way to get everybody thinking conceptually mm-hmm. and willing to jump into the deep waters with us, because mm-hmm. it's quite a risk to say to somebody, they're here and they're so seamless that you think it's just they woke up one day and came up with this. Yeah. But really, it's a lot of risk. It's yeah. like ask somebody as saying, sing something. You know, it's like mm-hmm. To get them into dialogue with each yeah. other. And some of them, you don't see that reference whatsoever in the work that's here, but the through thread with all of them is the idea of the hotel and what it means. And I think we've seen now just a myriad of different approaches.
Yeah, and especially looking at that like hotels on film, this like cinematic archetype of the hotel. And that's really, mm-hmm. you know, if you've been through room 101, that's like apparent when you see these different keys and sort of attaching them. So what I think is really interesting about the way that each of these artists approached it is that there is something cinematic about all of them, even if that reference is not obvious in a way. So even just kind of this, like we keep using the word transgression or intimate, or you know, this intimate nature of like coming into a hotel room, of feeling like, oh, am I allowed in this space? Like it creates like this really exciting atmosphere for people. There's kind of like, it feels illicit or secret, but not in a like, you know, overt way, in a more kind of like just fun way.
Right. Yeah, I think that also the other thing that the hotel space does, we're all familiar with a hotel. So it allows folks who might not be comfortable going to see conceptual art or contemporary art to enter into the space, because the invitation of a hotel is welcoming. Mm-hmm. So you're familiar with the space, even if you're not familiar with the art. Mm-hmm. And so it's sort of the secret sauce.
Yeah.
And it brings you in. And then these artist presentations are very human, because the artist is there with the work. So you can, it's the one art show where you can say, what is this about? And you're not being rude. You're just having a good conversation. And there's been lots of great, it's about dialogue.
We wanted something that was like that, that felt like everyone was welcome, that there was an entry point for everyone. Mm-hmm. And that there is also like an incredible depth and a consideration. Like, I keep calling it a layer cake of collaboration, mm-hmm. because that's what it feels like to me, that like it's just interwoven into
Absolutely. Everything,
even
layered.
Yeah, even the audience interaction.
Mm-hmm. And this is I'm the part of the collaboration who, I don't have an exact affiliation with anyone, so I'm sort of observing this amazing collaboration between a hotel and an arts council, mm-hmm. in a small town. Mm-hmm. And this is really unique and incredible. Yeah. And it's sort of emblematic of a small town, that you can kind of cross these what would be seen as silos or barriers, yeah. and do something sort of spectacular together.
Yeah, I feel like we can't state enough that like the collaboration between County Arts and the Royal.
For the Local Journalism Initiative, frequencynews.ca, and CJPE County FM, I'm Brenda Little.
Coming up next, we have Dinah Jansen reading a story by Keith Dempsey, Local Journalism Initiative reporter for the Brockville Recorder and Times, about declining casino revenue payments in the township of Leeds and the Thousand Islands.
Thank you, Jesse. The Ontario Lottery and Gaming Corporation has issued fourth quarter gaming revenue payments of $185,356 each to the town of Gananoque and the township of Leeds and the Thousand Islands for hosting Shoreline's Casino Thousand Islands, continuing a downward trend in annual casino revenue for the two municipalities. The payments cover a period from January 1st to March 31st. For OLG's 2025-26 fiscal year, Gananoque and TLTI each received $873,544, down from approximately $938,000 in 2024-25. The latest payment also marks a decline from the previous quarter, when each municipality received $196,783 for the period October 1st to December 31st. Since Shoreline Casino Thousand Islands opened in June 2002, each municipality has received more than $34.4 million through OLG's municipal revenue sharing formula. While the payments remain a significant source of municipal income, annual revenue from the casino has steadily declined over the past decade. In the early 2010s, Gananoque and TLTI each received more than $1.8 million annually, more than double the current amount. Municipal officials have acknowledged that casino revenues are unlikely to return to those historical levels and have emphasized the need to reduce reliance on gaming revenue by diversifying income sources. The OLG said gaming hosting payments help municipalities fund community services and infrastructure projects. Thank you to Keith Dempsey for that story. Now over to Ted Evans, LGI reporter for CJAI-FM Amherst Island Radio, with a story on new green initiatives in Lennox and Addington County.
Hi, I'm Ted Evans, local journalism initiative reporter and news director at CJAI, Amherst Island Radio, 101.3 FM in Stella, Ontario. Coming up are some of the top news stories from Loyalist Township. You can hear Amherst Island Radio's news program, North Shore News, on 101.3 Amherst Island Radio or online at cjai.ca. For showtimes throughout the week, check the schedule on our website at cjai.ca.
For Earth Day this year, Lennox and Addington County Council and staff have committed to conscious consumption practices going forward. This comes as an effort to take the environment into account, as is outlined in the county's Climate Action Plan. This year, the county decided on the theme of conscious consumption. Warden Nathan Townend talked about the 2026 theme.
This year's theme is conscious consumption. The 2026 theme aims to encourage citizens, municipalities, organizations, and businesses to commit to conscious practices, whether that's energy-related, material, digital, organizational, behavioral, or collective. This theme aligns with the County of Lennox and Addington's Climate Action Plan, which challenges us to take the environment into account in all of our decision-making. This commitment to conscious consumption by council and staff will help to maintain a strong, resilient, and responsible county community for years to come.
For Amherst Island Radio and the Local Journalism Initiative, I'm Ted Evans.
And thank you to Ted Evans for that story. Now over to Jesse Bell with CFRC's Sports Report.
Thank you, Dinah. The 2026 CFL Draft takes place tonight starting at 7 p.m. A launching point for Canadian collegiate players that are looking to make that jump into the pro ranks, this year's draft is heavy on top-tier NCAA talent. The projected top pick is Ottawa's Akeem Mezidor, an overager defensive lineman from the University of Miami. Mezidor played 3 years of high school football in Ontario before transferring to a school in Florida. Mezidor would earn scholarship offers from a number of NCAA Division I programs before ultimately committing to West Virginia. After three strong seasons as a Mountaineer, Mezidor would transfer to Miami, where he was a key player for the Hurricanes, who finished 2025 with a close loss to Indiana in the college football national title game. It is worth noting that Mezidor is also projected to be a first-round NFL draft pick, which may discourage teams from selecting him in the early rounds of the CFL draft. There are six Queens Gaels who are eligible for selection in the CFL draft. Alex Vraken is rated as the draft's fifth best quarterback prospect. Scouts were impressed with his pocket mobility and arm talent, but he's not expected to be taken in the draft. It looks likely that Vraken will return to Queens in the fall for his fifth and final year of eligibility. H-back Liam Silverson scored a viral moment at the regional combine with an incredible one-handed catch, but some testing struggles will likely discourage teams from drafting him. Free safety John Korskaden attended the CFL regional combine in Waterloo, but his smaller frame and more cerebral skill set tend not to translate well in a physical testing environment, so it's unlikely he'll be drafted either. The three Gaels with the most buzz in the CFL draft are defensive lineman Stephen Kapea, linebacker Justin Pace, and offensive lineman Nicholas Hennig. Kapea turned heads with his regional combine performance at Waterloo. His measurables were so strong that they earned him a trip to Edmonton for the national combine. Though he is undersized for his position on the defensive line, Kapea is immensely athletic with blinding speed and an impressive collection of pass rush moves. He is projected as a late round project player, but it's possible that he may go undrafted and try to earn a spot on a team with a training camp invite. Linebacker Justin Pace earned a National Combine invite thanks to 3 years of impressive all-conference and all-Canadian caliber play. The Montreal native played his high school football in Florida before committing to Queens in 2021. Pace would likely go in the draft's later rounds if he's drafted at all. An inside source reported that Pace has been in discussions with the Hamilton Tiger Cats and the Edmonton Elk in particular. He does plan on returning to Queens for his fifth year regardless of how the draft shakes out. No other prospect has risen the ranks as quickly as Queens offensive lineman Nicholas Henning. An H-back turned tackle, Henning has impressive physical measurables standing at an imposing 6'7" and weighing just under 300 pounds. He also boasts long, powerful arms and a shocking level of agility and overall athleticism for a man of his size. Henning turned in an outstanding national combine, receiving a grade of 91.2 out of 100, by far the highest score of all the players who participated. He is projected to be the first U Sports player drafted, likely in the early to mid second round, but it would not surprise me to see him taken as a first round draft pick. Henning has also received interest from a handful of NFL teams, including the Arizona Cardinals. Nicholas Henning does have another year of U Sports eligibility, so it is possible that he returns to Queens in the fall for another year of seasoning. The CFL draft is scheduled to begin tonight at 7 p.m. on TSN.
And thank you to Jesse Bell for that update, and also to our sponsor. Today's edition of The Corridor is brought to you by Kim Purcell of Sutton Group Masters Realty. Learn more about Kim and local listings for your new home via kimpurcell.ca. Coming up, we have the CFRC Environment Canada weather forecast for the Kingston region.
Thank you, Dinah. This is Jesse Bell from CFRC with your Environment Canada weather report for the week. We begin with Tuesday, April 28th. Rainy day here in the city of Kingston. Daytime high of 12 degrees with an 84% chance of precipitation throughout the day, dropping down to 8 overnight. That 12-degree temperature point remains consistent heading into Wednesday, April 29th. This time, though, we have a 91% chance of precipitation, and it's going to be quite a heavy amount of rain as well. Going to feel closer to 11 degrees, so a little bit of humidity, but mostly a wet and somewhat chilly day here in the city of Kingston. Thursday, April 30th, daytime high of 10 degrees. Less chance of rain, but we are going to have cloudy conditions, and those 2 days of rain leading into it have certainly cooled things off heading into Friday, May 1st. New month, same weather, mix of sun and showers throughout the day, about a 64% chance of precipitation, daytime high of 9 degrees, dropping down to 2 overnight, and heading into the weekend, the first weekend of May, it's going to feel more like March. Daytime high of 6 degrees on Saturday, May 2nd, partly sunny and chilly with showers in the forecast, and Sunday, May 3rd, daytime high of 7, feeling closer to 4 with a 60% chance of precipitation. That remains consistent into the start of next week. Monday, May 4th, high of 9, 55% chance of precipitation. And then Tuesday, May 5th, the first nice day in the month of May. 13 degrees is your high, but it's going to feel a little bit warmer at around 15 with a mix of sun and cloud.
And that's a wrap for this week's edition of The Corridor, supported by the Local Journalism Initiative and the Community Radio Fund of Canada. Don't forget to visit CFRC.ca for the latest in local and regional news headlines, concert and events listings, and more. You can also follow CFRC on Facebook and Instagram at CFRC Music and on Twitter X at CFRC. You can support CFRC and its independent news programming by donating via CFRC.ca. We'll be back next week with more in local and regional news. Thank you for joining us. Thank you for listening to this podcast produced at CFRC 101.9 FM at Queen's University in Kingston, Ontario, situated on the traditional territories of the Anishinaabe and Haudenosaunee peoples, and brought to you by the generous support of Smith Engineering.
When it comes to Kingston real estate, local experience matters. Kim Purcell is an award-winning realtor born and raised in Kingston with over a decade of experience and 100 five-star reviews. If you want honest advice and results you can trust, choose Kim. Visit kimpurcell.ca today for more information.
Live music fans, get ready. Spring Reverb returns for its fifth edition May 28th through the 31st in downtown Kingston, Ontario, and CFRC is thrilled to be part of the action. Over 4 days, you can catch live music panels, workshops, and see what makes the Kingston music scene tick. Get ready for acts like Bedouin Soundclash, The Dirty Nil, Hot Garbage, By Divine Rights, Slaves of Spanky, Pony Girl, Tanya Iyer, Golden Feather, and so much more. Also, make sure to check out all the free panels, workshops, a merch market, and the first ever Cataraqui Punk Rock Flea Market. For more information on the lineup and tickets, visit kppconcerts.com or Spring Reverb YGK on socials. See you there.
Down the short set of stairs, join me, Grim, in the basement for my working knowledge of indie, experimental, post-punk, and electronic every Wednesday from 10 until 11 p.m. on CFRC 101.9 FM. Get ready to press record.
Hello, I'm Dion Jones from Alpha, North Wales. You're listening to CFRC Radio in Kingston, Ontario.
Welcome to Grad Chat, your opportunity to find out about graduate research here at Queen's. My name is KM on the FM, and I'm your host for this week's Grad Chat. This is a rebroadcast. Please disregard any reference to dates or times. A show like this could not happen without the support of the School of Graduate Studies and Postdoctoral Affairs and CFRC. So a big thank you to both of them. If you missed the show at any time, you can download the podcast the next day on either iTunes, Google Podcasts, Spotify, or CFRC Podcast. It is a great way to stay informed about all the exciting research our graduate students and postdocs are working on. So today, I would like to introduce you to Emily Croft, who is working on a PhD in art history under the supervisions of Dr. Kathleen Henninger and Christiana Zaccanino. Welcome to GradChat, Emily.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Well, thanks for coming on the show. And before we dive into your research today, can you tell us a little bit about your journey up until this point? So what brought you to Queen's for art history?
Well, I actually started at Queen's in 2016, and I did my undergrad here in classics. It used to be called classical studies. Now it's classics and archaeology. And then I did a master's in that as well, and at Queen's. And I took a year off after my master's and pondered, you know, what was the next best step for me, and ended up deciding on joining the art history department to do a PhD because I wanted to focus more on what happens to archaeological objects after they've come out of the ground rather than the process of finding them. And so the art history department is extremely multidisciplinary, and they give you the opportunity to study museums, museology, heritage preservation, and that's where I ended up.
Oh, very nice. So you've been at Queen's for a while, but you've taken a few different paths and tried a few different programs.
Yeah.
And you started to tell us a little bit about it, but can you tell us about your current PhD project?
Yes, absolutely. So first I have to say thank you very much to SHRC for giving me funding for the next 3 years. I'm extremely grateful for that opportunity. But my funding is covering my research on the development of archaeological museums in Sardinia, Italy from 1861 until 1939. So those 2 dates are defined by 1861 is when Italy becomes a country. So beforehand, it's just a bunch of these different little regions. And then there's this big movement that's led out of the north to make Italy one nation. And then the 1939 is defined by a piece of legislation that was signed in under the fascist government, which was really the last big piece of legislation dealing with cultural heritage until like 1999. And so what I'll be doing is looking at how objects are being uncovered, the reasons for them being uncovered, and then why they're ending up in a museum. I would like to look at it through a cultural political lens, because as I've been learning throughout my research is that objects are being excavated and ending up in museums, not for purely historical purposes, but their excavation and display can be very tied to what is happening from a top-down narrative. And so what is the government trying to do and what story do they want to tell? And so in terms of Sardinia, I'll be looking at it through both the movement for nationalism and then also the fascist movement, which most people know, some might not, that that was very tied to classical antiquities, to what was coming out of ancient Rome. I'm also really interested in finding out who are the main actors in this process, so archaeologists, politicians, and then looking at where the objects are coming from. Are they coming from digs? Are they coming from being falsely manufactured? That is seemingly where it's heading right now.
Oh, very interesting. It seems very timely as well to be thinking about how cultural institutions and can be co-opted or utilized by governments to advance certain agendas or certain narratives.
Absolutely. Yeah, it's unfortunately becoming extremely relative, as I had maybe naively assumed that museums were truth tellers. And I think it's really leading towards an advance of that might not be the case. So,
So we'll. I think your topic is very topical, although it is in maybe a region that people are less familiar with. Can you tell us a little bit about Sardinia in general? I'm not sure where the region is myself.
Absolutely, yeah. And so Sardinia, if we think of Italy as the boot, as we normally do, if you go west of about 200 kilometers, there's an island, and that is the island of Sardinia. And so it's about 200 kilometers from Italy. It's about 200 kilometers from North Africa. And it is this now a semi-autonomous region of Italy since 1947, but it is still a part of that country. Because of its geographical positioning, it's actually created this really fantastic sort of blended culture that comes out a lot in the archaeology. But the people have a really unique sense of pride, of regional pride, which is partly what led me to doing my research there.
Oh, very cool. And when you're looking at an archaeological museum, I'm curious to know how that differs from, say, another type of museum, maybe like the Museum of Healthcare or the Agnes Etherington Gallery on campus. What differs in an archaeological museum from maybe those types of sites?
Yeah, so I think part of it is their genesis. So a lot of these museums are being formed from antiquarian collections. And so these are people who in the late 1700s, 1800s are very fascinated with the relics of our past, and they put them into their own private collections before donating them to usually a royal institution like university. And then universities decide, we want this to be a singular collection. And so one of the museums that I look at is now the Archaeological Museum of the University of Cagliari, or it was associated with the University of Cagliari, and it's in Sardinia, and that's how it started. And now it totally encompasses just archaeological artifacts. And I think this differs versus something like the Museum of Healthcare, like you mentioned, in the fact that it's what the collections are focusing on.
Okay, yeah.
Because we have in Ottawa, we've got our Museum of History, and it does include archaeological artifacts, but that's not its focus. And so I think that is kind of the two differentiating factors.
Oh, that makes sense. No, it's so about the creation of the collection, the age of the collection, the type of collection, those types of things. Yes. So are there lots of museums in your study for your PhD, or are there a certain amount of sites? Like, did you have to set parameters to keep it to a reasonable sized study?
So Sardinia is relatively small geographically. And so having that geographical limit helpful. The other limiter was the time frame. Looking at it from between 1861 to 1939, that's narrowed me down to about five institutions, two of which are in the major centers of the island. So Cagliari in the south and Sassari in the north. And then I think there's three other smaller institutions that were either founded in the late 1800s or just before the increase of fascism. And so that was, luckily I had those limits, because Italy with its, you know, very extensive material past, there are archaeological museums all throughout the country that are, you know, have been founded from the country's inception, even beforehand, and still are being, you know, founded. And so it was very helpful to have those two kind of parameters.
Yes, I can only imagine how you would have, you have to finish your PhD sometime, right? So if, yeah. I'm glad that you have a kind of a natural fit that within the region that just delineates what sites you'll study. So within these, so you've got these five cultural sites and heritage sites, but what role did these archaeological museums in Sardinia or in Italy generally play in shaping an understanding of the ancient past? You've touched on this a little bit, but I'd like to dig into it more.
Right. So I can tell you a lot about the rest of Italy, but that's where my research comes in, which is about in terms of Sardinia. And that was my, you know, that ever faithful gap that PhD students are looking for. So Italy, as I had mentioned, is a conglomeration of a bunch of distinct regions that had their own languages, dialects, food styles, clothing, you know, very different places, that in the 1800s, it was decided that they would become one nation. But there was a lot of pushback because of how distinct all of these geographic places were. And so it was decided that archaeology was going to be used as one of these ways of justifying why these nations should now come together as one country.
Oh, okay.
And so what ended up happening is they would do digs and they would find, you know, ancient artifacts and say, oh, they are all belonging to one culture that's come from the north and has civilized down into the south, which mirrored the unification process of the country. And then these objects, as they're being put into museums, that's the story that they're telling, is that it's giving them that historical justification for why the people should accept being now in one country.
So creating, well, I guess this is up to interpretation, but either creating or sharing a shared ancient past between all of these different previously autonomous regions throughout Italy.
So when we get into the fascist period, the focus then starts to lay on classical objects. And so objects coming from the ancient Romans, as opposed to societies that existed before them. And museums are also promoting those objects. And there's all of these exhibitions that are taking place, both to put on focus these objects that are being found in Italy, but also objects that are coming from Northern Africa, which Italy had colonized at that time, to justify why Italy should be, you know, the holders of these African nations.
So it sounds like a little bit of hearkening back to the idea of like a golden past or a golden age of past empires or regions, and that the new Italian governments, newly formed Italian governments, were using this as justification to continue those holdings.
Absolutely, yeah. It was a justification for Mediterranean hegemony.
Okay, yeah. No, that makes, it makes sense. And what a role to play, right? If museums are telling these really powerful stories that connect people, and depending on who's writing those stories, right, or interpreting those, it can be used in many different ways, as you've explained to us. You touched on this a little bit, that you've chosen Sardinia because it hasn't been explored in the same way that other parts of Italy have been in relation to archaeological museums. And you mentioned again, like, that it's geographically unique, as it's kind of a little more isolated as it's an island. But are there any other things that make Sardinia unique that you are excited to look for as you start or continue your studies?
Ooh, that's a great question. I think it's just understanding, I guess perhaps it's to say the truth behind it, because starting in the 1960s is when it became a very prominent idea of Sardinian separatism. And that a lot of archaeology and archaeological collections then start promoting this unique identity compared to Italy. And it's really taken over museum collections. And I'm interested to know as to when that starts and to kind of compare what's happening in Sardinia to what's happening on the mainland to see, is this really the case? Is there any justification for this movement? There is a whole cultural political reasoning as to why Sardinians feel this way, in that they themselves feel very distinct. A lot of people I know, you know, they're Sardinians first, Italian second maybe, and they feel that they have been treated very poorly in the grand scheme of the Italians, and they are disadvantaged when it comes to access to resources, education, ability. And so I would like to see if I can blend how people are feeling with what I interpret to be my own, you know, academic truth.
It sounds like you're looking for long trends and trajectories of narratives shifting over time and seeing how they map or don't map onto political and cultural movements at the same time. Would that be fair to say?
Absolutely. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. No, that sounds very interesting because I think, like we mentioned, there's a lot of contemporary movements of reshaping identities at regional, national, global levels. So I think that even though you might be looking into the 19th or 20th century, I think you're going to see a lot of echoes into the 21st century as well.
Absolutely. Yeah.
This all sounds very interesting, and it's been so far more high level, but I'm very curious about how you approach this research. Like, what are some research methods that you use to study these? Like, what does a research day look like for you when you're studying Sardinia?
A lot of what I've been doing is just desperately trying to access books. Because it's not very well published about in English, it means a lot of our libraries here in Canada don't have those books. So our fantastic library team has been interlibrary loaning things for me. A lot of it right now is because I am in the early stages of doing that primary research, is combing through footnotes, looking for references to museum collections and archival material. That's been the last few weeks. And I'm actually preparing to leave tomorrow to go to Italy.
Oh, amazing.
To do some archival research. So actually access these documents myself.
So with the archives, what types of archives are you going to be going into? Are these state, national? Are they the museums themselves? Can you tell us a little bit more about what those are going to be like?
Yeah. So right now the plan is for the next 2 months, I'm going to be in Sardinia. And I will start with going to the central archives of the state, which they have different locations throughout Italy. I'm going to start with the one in Cagliari, which is the capital city. I will also go to the historic archive, the city itself, and then the archive of the superintendency, which is the governmental heritage agency that overlooks all cultural heritage within Italy. So that's where I'll start, and then going to the museums themselves. And then if I have time and or the need, I will access the same institutions up in Sassari, which is about 3 hours to the north, and visit their museum there, as well as the other three that I've identified.
Oh, very interesting. It sounds like it's going to be hopefully a very fruitful trip. Lots of records, I hope. Do Sardinian officials or Italian officials keep strong records of cultural heritage, or is it a little more ad hoc in the type of records they've kept over the years?
Oh, no, they everything has been kept. As far as I've found, it's just dependent on what has been digitized and what has ended up in Sardinia, which is a lot of letters between archaeologists and government officials versus what's being held in Rome, which I think is my next step in the new year, is to then go to Rome and access the giant archive of the state. And that's where most of the information is kept on how these museums are fitting into legislation and those different aspects.
Well, it's going to be very interesting because I think you're going to have, it sounds like you'll have a lot of different narratives to follow and see how they all, you know, end up being expressed in museums, because you're going to have stories from archaeologists who, you know, maybe have, I don't think neutral is the right word because I don't think a lot of stuff can be neutral, but maybe altruistic or just excitement about, you know, an excavation of a site and objects, and then, you know, more bureaucratic officials who have a certain idea of what should be found or what should be presented, and seeing those kind of competing ideas and what ends up, you know, being put forward to the public. I think that sounds like it's going to be very fun for you to trace all of those different stories.
Absolutely, yeah. And that's something I am lucky to actively excavate in Sardinia. And I like to think that I am just doing it because I'm so fascinated with what's coming out of the ground. But then, yes, I'd like to backtrack and say, you know, historically, is that what's going on? Or is there this greater message that's looking at them, that they're, you know, I have to find something that's justifying Sardinia's connection to this larger plot of nationalism, or yeah.
And I guess, sorry, I enjoy records, so I'm curious about what languages are you going to encounter, or dialects, and how do you work with these different records that, you know, might might speak to one another, or there might be things lost in translation, but between both, you know, regional speakers and mainland speakers and those things. But how do you work with all of these different languages you might encounter?
Yeah, so the one that I'll primarily be working in is Italian, which I am very lucky that I have been able to pick up over the last 3 years of working in and out of Sardinia, and I took some classes at Queen's. Mm. So I'm fairly proficient, I'd like to say. It's just when we start getting into older versions of languages, that's where it becomes a little bit fuzzy. And so I think it's just going to be a lot of patience looking at your travel records and seeing, you know, how does this word, it looks similar? Is it what I'm actually looking for? Also in Sardinia, I mean, every place in Italy has its own dialect. Sardinia also has its own language. It's called Sardo. It's mostly now a spoken language. There is a resurgence in teaching it to the younger generation, but it's not written in, I guess I should say. But one of the early directors of the museum in Cagliari, he was actually a priest and a linguist. So he is coevally doing a lot of studies on the objects, but also the formation of the language. And so I'm very interested to see if, you know, the two pop up in conjunction. Unfortunately, I only know a few phrases in Sardinian, and so I might need some help, but we'll see where I can get that from. Because most young people don't necessarily speak it. But there are dictionaries that exist, so we'll see what I can do.
That'll be very interesting, because I wonder too, you know, in official records, if there's been a push for like a federalization of the state, will Sardo be included in those records or not, right? Or will it be all in Italian?
Right.
To go with the unification.
Even Italian as a language itself is sort of constructed because it was decided to base it off of the accent and dialect that was coming from Florence. That was decided what Italian was going to be. And so, you know, there's probably a push that would be the language used for all official commentary. And so, it will be interesting to see if there is a resurgence on a broader level at some point of the Sardinian language.
Oh, very cool. And I'd like to just ask, like, what impact are you hoping your research to have? Because this project sounds like it would be of interest to a lot of folks, both in the region, but also for the kind of broader implications, right, about how narratives about identity are constructed. So what impact are you hoping to have?
Absolutely. So on the easiest answer level is that I would just really like to see something in English written about the history of Sardinia, because it has become an island that's very dear to me, and sharing the love that I have for the island and the people and the history, making that more broadly accessible, like kind of transnationally, that is a huge goal that I have. But you're right, on a more current level is this issue that we're seeing where the government can dictate what stories are being told, and that is part of what I would like to do with my research, is have it be perhaps written in a more accessible way that can warn people as to the dangers of what can happen when we aren't using history as a truth, that we have to be extremely aware of the fact that what we're seeing from the past might not necessarily be a fact. Because that was really, I was so naive when I started. And now I just have such a huge appreciation for the critical thinking skills that I've learned throughout my whole university career, that I can now think, what is the purpose of what's being presented? And how should I, you know, how should I interpret it through my own, you know, my own background and what I've learned? And I'm very privileged that I go to university, but I come from a community where not a lot of people do. And so I would really like to have some sort of outcome where on a smaller scale, I can, you know, maybe impart some of these warnings, I guess. That sounds a bit weak, but it's become very relevant lately.
No, I think we could all use a refresher on the importance of critical thinking and critical interpretations of narratives and storytelling. Wow. And then what a powerful tool storytelling is, but to understand that it is, can be used in many different ways, as most tools can be. Yeah. And I wanted to ask as well, because you've mentioned some objects and some and records, but what is the most memorable object you've encountered in your research so far? Do you have any favorites?
Yeah, as of right now, I've been doing a lot of looking into, they're called the false idols. So they were these bronze idols. So these little statues that are often of animals or people that are very particular to the Sardinian Bronze Age culture called the Neolithic civilization. And they do find them very frequently, but in the mid-1800s, all of a sudden, there are these very important telling idols of particular goddesses, and they start circulating throughout European universities and museums. But it turns out that they're actually fake, that they were made in somebody's workshop in Cagliari, Sardinia, to kind of fuel this desire to find objects from this particular civilization. And so those are my favorite ones right now.
Oh, those are very interesting. So now they're historic in one sense, but they are not ancient in the way that they were presented.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah. And so I'm excited to hopefully get my hands on some of them when I go to Italy next week, but we'll see.
Oh, I hope. Yes. I hope you get to encounter the false idols. And what a great name too, for some of very on the nose for some of the things you're studying, some of the big themes. So as you mentioned, you're headed to Italy, but by the time this episode airs, you will be well on your way on your research. But can you tell us a little bit about your plans? I know you've touched on this a little bit. You'll be going there for about 2 months, but outside of archives, what else will you be doing? Anything fun on top of all the research that you're doing?
So I'm actually starting my trip by going to Naples, which I've never seen before, and I'm going to visit Pompeii.
Oh, very cool.
Which I'm just absolutely chuffed about because I've never been there, and I've done a lot of research on it through my master's. So that's step one. And then it will be a lot of archival research, but hopefully some traveling around Sardinia as well, because I'm quite lucky. I have a lot of friends there now who are different parts of the island, and I would love to be able to see where they're from, because usually I only see them in the summers when we're doing archaeology together. So step one is doing the archives, and then I'll be back in Canada, and then at some point in the spring I will go to the UK, because there are some Sardinian objects that have made their way to the British Museum. Ashmolean Museum, and then I'll be doing archival work there as well, because there are some items of correspondence that I'd like to see. And you know, it's jolly old England who doesn't want to explore there. And then I will be back into Italy late spring next year, I think, but into Rome to go into that state archives that I mentioned. And then hopefully by the midsummer I will be back excavating at the site that I work at, that's called Nora, and it's right on the southern coast of Sardinia, and it's a fantastic site. And actually, as I'm excavating, we're finding traces of people who were excavating there in the 1800s.
Oh, very interesting.
Yeah. And so that was one of the things that had led me to this project, was 2 summers ago, we found traces of people digging trenches, they were looking for tombs at that point. But, that I think feeds very well into what I study. of archaeology again, and like the museums isn't just about science fact, it's about sometimes you're kind of light treasure hunting.
Well, that's so great that you have the archaeological experience to support your understanding of this project as well. So it seems like you're going to have a very holistic approach that maybe not everyone else would have without all this great archaeological experience you have from your master's and your undergrad. Well, thank you, Emily, so much for telling us all about your research. It's been great chatting with you. Best of luck on your research trip. And yes, hopefully you'll have to come back on Grad Chat in the future and tell us about what you've found so far.
I would love to. Thank you so much for having me.
So that's it, everyone. Another week of Grad Chat comes to an end. Don't forget, you can download the show tomorrow from either iTunes, Google Podcasts, Spotify, or CFRC Podcast. Just search Grad Chat. And until next week, this is KM on the FM.
Are you between 14 and 30 years old and interested in organizing a French language activity for youth in your community? The VIF program can make it happen. You could receive $850 to create your activity, and your partnering organization could get $150 to support it. Bring your idea to life. Visit programvif.ca and apply today.
Oh, hey, Boomer Radio Guy. You're looking pretty good. Long time no see.
Stack them eights, yo-yo. Feel free to let your tongue down and hammer away with words that make you feel good.
Okay, well, I'm not really sure what that means, but now that I've seen you, I wanted to tell you, I got my own radio show. It's on Saturday mornings from 8 till 10. It's called Making Bacon.
Hey, Beaver, the place to get help is on Channel 9, and I'll do a 10-5 about that motion lotion all over this here slab.
I don't know what that means, but I don't think you should be saying stuff like that.
Keep the shiny side up and the dirty side down.
Okay, whoa, okay, look. It's just Saturday mornings from 8 until 10. Check it out. Making Bacon, CFRC 101.9.
Idle talk is a nuisance. Get out there and do it to it. Love and kisses.